Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of The Future Path. This is the place where I talk to other 20-somethings about how they manage money, career, and relationships in their own ways, so we can all learn from each other, grow, and figure out life together. This time, I talked to Finlay Fehlauer. He's a friend of mine and honestly an incredibly impressive guy who got an internship at Bloomberg when he was 16 and started a company in the financial services industry shortly after. Even though he's somewhat naturally gifted in a sense that he's really good at academics, which most of us aren't, I think we can all learn a lot about his experiences on how to make the most out of the chances you're given, why you need to know your passion, and how we should think about and handle money. Enjoy. Just a reminder that all the information shared on this podcast is for entertainment and informational purposes only and should not be taken as financial advice. Always consult with a professional first before making any big financial decisions. Welcome, Finlay, to The Future Path.
Nice to see you. To talk to you.
Thank you for having the time.
You too.
So this is your first podcast ever?
Yeah, it is. First podcast experience.
Cool. For me, it's the fourth.
Nice. Well, I'm glad to be on the podcast. So
yeah.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm glad to have you. How old are you and what do you do?
So I'm 19 years old right now. I will be 20 in the summer, so just a month from now. And I'm a student in computer science at ETH Zurich. But my, so to speak, full-time profession is being a founder, where we founded a software company that provides software for financial service industry.
How much time does each of these take?
Well, that kind of depends on the season, so to speak. Honestly, during the regular semester, I do very little for university. I like to focus my time on the company, working there, managing everything. But obviously, during exam season, it's exam season. So most of the year, I would say my company is like 100% full-time, and then it kind of flips to the opposite in 4 weeks for August.
Yeah. So you're in your master's now?
No, I'm still finishing up my bachelor's.
Yeah.
So I started my bachelor's in 2021 and did my first semester, passed the exams, but I wanted to take a year off to found my company to get everything started. So that's exactly what I did. So basically 2022, I didn't do anything for uni because I just took time to meet my co-founders, set up the company. We got started and started working together. And since 2023, I'm back at university and now I do, I guess, both. So right now I'm in fourth semester and I will finish my fourth semester this summer, do my fifth semester. And then for my sixth, I will go abroad. But then I'm basically done with my bachelor's.
Mm-hmm. So you're 19 and you already started a company?
I guess so, yeah.
Damn. How did that happen?
Well, to me, I always had this dream of, I always wanted to do something on my own. I think from a young age, I've been very much driven and passionate and always wanted to do something on my own, get something started. But I never really knew what to do, right? Like, I had this idea in my mind, and obviously you read the news, you read like, oh, these, like the Steve Jobs story, found something in the garage and then make it into a $1 billion business, right? And I found this narrative to be extremely compelling. But I never had anything, no real idea to go about. So then in 2021, I guess it was more of a coincidence. I'm a subscriber to The Economist, and I just read in The Economist about like SME financing in Africa and what's the problems there. And that kind of brought me down a rabbit hole where like I looked at it and was super fascinated and was like, hell yeah, I want to learn more about this, right? It seems interesting. It seems like something where you could do something, you know?
What's SME?
SME is small and medium enterprises. So basically here in Switzerland, you can have credit cards, and if you have a business, you can go to a bank and get a loan. And we have a whole financial system. You know, obviously Bahnhofstrasse, one of the biggest financial centers in the world. Mm-hmm. Whereas in Africa, that was kind of the content of the article, this doesn't exist. And it opened this question of like, what is necessary to get to a financial system? What is necessary to provide capital? And I mean, right now, we are not really working on that anymore, but it really got me into this idea of, how does this whole work? you know, what can be done there. And I just started to explore. And I think that's the biggest thing about founding a company. Like, I've decided, okay, this seems interesting. I want to know more. And then I just dug in deeper. I sent emails. I tried to learn more about it. And then step by step, I kind of dug into this whole area of finance, how this financing and securitization and structured finance and everything what goes beyond, mm-hmm. kind of behind the scenes in the financial system, how that all works. And after a while, I saw that and I thought about it and was like, okay, now I have an idea. That's kind of how it started.
So you would say you know the financial system a bit better than the average.
Yeah, probably.
20-year-old. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, obviously it was kind of perfect timing. On the one hand, I read this article and dug in deeper and did my kind of own exploration. But at the same time, I also took a job in finance. I worked at Bloomberg. And then obviously there, I also learned way, way more about finance and had access to resources that you really couldn't get otherwise. And so it kind of was kind of a perfect combination of opportunities for me to explore. And after I did that, I had, I think, way, way, way more background knowledge.
Yeah. Let's get back to that. You got an internship at Bloomberg at 17, right?
Yeah, well, I was 16 when I got that, but yeah.
Internship at Bloomberg with 16.
Yeah.
How did you manage to do that?
That's a crazy story. I always did something in computer science or software engineering. We had, like, in high school, there was this thing called, like, Berufspraktika, or, like, basically internships where they wanted you to kind of explore a bit what you can do and maybe what you want your future career to be like. And I wanted to do something in software, so I did mine in the software engineering field. And that gave me loads and loads of opportunities to develop and to actually already work in the software engineering area. So I already did a lot of that in high school. I worked at various different companies, like smaller to medium-sized companies, and that gave me a bit of experience. And then in 2021, I wanted to go to the US to study and then apply mm-hmm. to a bunch of universities, and I got rejected, right? So, you know.
Why did you get rejected?
Well, I guess, you know, some things are not meant to happen, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like, you cannot get everything. But I think for me, this experience really taught me that, like, how you deal with rejection and what you do with that makes a difference. Because my reaction was like, okay, you know, shit happens, so I will do something else now. And basically, after I had these rejections, my idea was, okay, then you know what? I know one thing that I can do. I can work in software engineering. I already did a paid internship before in the previous summer. And I was like, okay, how about I just focus on getting a job, right? I wanted mm-hmm. to work for a big company. And this was like my kind of goal that I set as a replacement.
Yeah.
And I basically just try to do that, right? I went on LinkedIn, you know, as a 16-year-old, like I wrote my CV and then I just send it to literally every job I could find. You know, I scrolled LinkedIn day and night, just applied everywhere.
Did you have some projects to show experience?
Well, I mean, I could talk about the previous projects I did in the internships I did before. You know, I did this, one company I worked at, they did a consulting project for BMW. And obviously, I think this is kind of, I didn't work directly for BMW, but it's a big name. And so you can kind of talk about that. And I think that also catches people's attention. And I always had this mindset that when I work somewhere, I want to learn how I provide value. You know, I want to see the big picture and I want to see how it works. And I really focused also on the business value when I worked at these companies, like trying to understand what is the business case of what I'm building here. And I think this really reflected well in my CV, which is also what in the end got me the Bloomberg internship, that I was probably the most underqualified person who applied there. You know, I didn't have a high state. They asked for like ideally master's degree or something like that was in the job description. And I just applied blindly. But, you know, when I was in the interviews, I could tell them, yeah, I did this, I don't know, Java coding, right? But I didn't just tell them like I did Java coding. I told them like this was relevant because it enabled this or this business aspect for, let's say, BMW. What was the goal of the project? how did I create value and how did I provide value as a software engineer to this company?
Yeah.
And I think this aspect was one of the biggest drivers that also then got me the job, because everyone can do like the bare minimum, right? You can code, you can learn these interview questions, but then you have to provide something on top of that to stand out of the crowd. And I think my value in that sense was I focused on what can I do. And that's how I got the job.
Damn, that's some solid advice. Because when I think about internships, I think about a relaxing time and you follow some like executive or some manager of a project behind the scenes and you just look what they do, right? You don't really have the opportunity to do something really valuable for the company, usually. That's like my impression of internships. How did you manage to break out of that? And because usually if you get an internship, people, they don't think you can do that much.
Yeah, but you know, that was, for me, that was the challenge. You know, that was the whole thrill of it. Because I did my first internship in high school. I think I was like 13 at the time. You know, it was one of those mandatory ones where you had to do it. And I showed up to this local software engineering company and they didn't expect me to do anything, right? I was 13. They expected someone there who didn't know how to code and basically who would sit there and he'd be happy with like looking at the screen for a couple of hours a day. And then after 2 weeks, you'd send him home, right? And when I was there, I had this mindset that I don't want to be just seen as this person who is just sitting there to just check off a box, right? And so I learned how to code. I focused on Java engineering. And even though they gave me this kind of mini project to work on, I had this mindset that, okay, I am going to go in there and I will make their jaws drop, you know? Like I was cocky and an absolute arrogant 13-year-old, right? But that was kind of my mindset that you go in there and I will give 200%, you know, just to make sure that I exceed even their wildest expectations.
How did you get that mindset though?
I don't know. It was like my parents or like in my family, it's always this attitude that you should do something properly, right? Giving 10% of effort is not worth doing because then you might as well not do it at all.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I was passionate about software engineering. It was not that I was forced to do this. I had the opportunity to do any job in the world, right? Any career that I ever wanted to look at. And I was like, okay, I want to look at software engineering. I'm interested in that. And if I'm going to look at that, why should I just go there and do some menial project?
Yeah.
Because I want this to be my career, right?
Yeah.
I want to see if I can actually do what they are doing right now. And if I have fun doing not a test project or playing with Legos, right? I want to see if this job is interesting for me. So I tried to do exactly that. Mm-hmm. And I think the team there was really great. Like, I think after a few days when they understood that I was hungry and I wanted to do something and I wanted to go the step beyond, they also gave me tasks and they also gave me the opportunity to. And I think this relationship is really important, because had they not given me the freedom and all the tasks and basically the support to really excel, I would not have found any joy in software engineering, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of like they get the 200%, you know.
They noticed, effort. Like they actually reflected your effort.
Yeah, they saw that I was eager and that I wanted to do something. And then it's kind of a two-sided relationship, right? I want to really put in effort, but then they also have to kind of give me something to work on. Mm-hmm. And I think there, my manager and the HR manager, they were really great. They supported me and they let me look into various different aspects of the company. They kind of put me in different departments and I really got to see a lot. And I think this changed my attitude, because after even just one day, you know, I was there the first day, and I came in and I wanted to do something and I gave 200% effort on the first day. This first impression counts, right? After the first day, they were like, okay, this guy, he's willing to do something.
Yeah.
That makes the difference.
Impressive. So you're saying 200% always. What does that concretely look like for you? Like, how can you give 200%?
Well, okay, this is kind of off topic, but maybe a story from my high school. Like, I am okay, I'm a smart guy, you know, like I think I did pretty well in school and I also put in some effort, but I noticed that if on the first day you make a good impression for the teacher, you can do whatever you want for the whole year, right? Like if in the first day you walk in and the teacher thinks you're a smart guy, mm-hmm. he will think so for the entire rest of the year. Mm-hmm. And no matter what you do, this first impression is what counts, right? Okay. I think this is true not just for high school, but also in this environment, because if you make a really good impression on the first day, if you kind of on the first day come in, want to do something, work your ass off just to make sure that the first impression works, then you can slack off 2 weeks after. But, you know, in their mind, you will be the guy who came in on the first day, sat down and just started to work like a maniac. And that was my thing. The first day I went into this company, they gave me sort of the orientation, gave me the project, and I was like, okay, let's get started. Mm-hmm. You know, opened Google, Googled everything, talked to my coworkers, tried to get as much information as possible, tried to do as much as possible just in the first 8 hours while I was there.
Damn.
Right? And I think it's not like you keep this up forever, right? Obviously, yeah. The week after that, I basically completely slacked off. Mm-hmm. But this small project was meant to keep me busy. And in the first 3 days, I basically finished it.
Done. Yeah.
And after that, it doesn't matter what you do because you will be the guy who finished the project in 3 days.
Yeah.
And that's how it works.
That's the impression. Yeah, interesting. I think this really is the philosophy of living your life to the fullest. Like some people could say living your life to the fullest is chilling, relaxing in nature. That's also a way to look at it. But you notice that you have some sort of, like you just have the brain power kind of. I think others do too.
Yeah, I mean, it's all about using your capabilities to the best, right? You know, if I were an artist and I wanted to do art, right? Mm-hmm. I wouldn't give 10% of my creative skill into a painting, right? You put in 100% of your creative skill into a painting.
Yeah.
And this, I think, is crucial because it's not like living your life to fullest or kind of the effort that I put in into the first day. It's not like you have to slave away for weeks on end. Mm-hmm. I think this sometimes it's kind of misrepresented in this workaholic lifestyle that you have to work 12 hours a day and you will never have free time. Yeah. Because what matters is really this impression and that you give the effort and you put in the effort, because this sets the tone of the environment. And if you give your best at work, you can also go home after 8 hours. You did your best. You put in 100% effort. Mm-hmm. You can still be happy. You can still have a life outside work. You can chill with your friends, do whatever you want.
Yeah.
But you're going to be at work 8 hours a day minimum, right? Mm. And it's up to you whether you
chill or...
Well, I mean, whether you would really enjoy work, try to get the most out of it, yeah. Or if you don't. Because to me, if you are not interested enough in your work to give 100% of effort, choose a different job. You know, go in a different career, go into a different sector. If you don't like what you do and if you don't enjoy it as much to give 100%, mm-hmm. then it's not the right job for you. Mm-hmm. And for me, software engineering, I enjoy it 100%. And so I'm also going to give 100%. I will enjoy what I do. And I really got, like, I guess, emotionally rewarded, so to speak, for my work doing there.
I feel like so many people are just stuck in a job they don't like and they need the money because their life expenses are too high and they are worried about switching jobs. They already have the mortgage for the house. They have children.
Yeah, I mean, look, in the end, that's also, I think, why I started so young. The best time to experience is when you're still broke and when everyone around you is broke. Obviously, I'm not going to pretend that if you're 40 years old and you already have a family and you have loans and debt, then obviously just changing into whatever other job mm-hmm. is going to be very, very hard for you. Mm-hmm. But that's why I think, especially at the young age, you have to take advantage of the freedom you get. Because if you're young, if you're like 13 like I was, and you do an internship in a company that you don't like, not a problem. You can just switch and do something else. Mm-hmm. And it's not going to be a problem because you don't have anyone to take care of. there's basically no consequences,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Mm. And I think that's why it's so crucial to figure this out, what you want to do at an early age, because that's still the age where you have the freedom to do whatever you want. You know, if you're married, if you have a girlfriend or a boyfriend, if you're in a relationship, then suddenly things start to get way, way more complicated and this freedom will start to diminish.
So to all of the 20-somethings out there, like, explore as much as you can, I would say.
Yeah.
Right?
Try to find your passion.
I feel like so many of us are just chilling at home or like traveling. I guess that's also a way to find your passion, to travel. But I immediately started studying after high school because I wanted to find out if computer science was for me. I'm still not sure it really is for me. You know, it's interesting. In my bubble, everyone kind of needs to go to uni.
Yeah.
But at some point you realize maybe there's nothing at uni for you. Maybe there's nothing that you really like at uni. But still, it's expected from my bubble or from society to study something.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? Like, was it the same in your bubble or...
Well, I mean, yeah, I think everyone expected from me to also study. But I think figuring out what you want to study and figuring out what you want to do in life are two different things, right? Because unless you want to go into academia, your job is and your career is not going to be at uni, right? If you are interested in computer science, you know, unless you're going to be a professor of computer science, you're not going to have a career at uni. You're maybe going to work at Google or in the software engineering field or something related to that. And that's, I think, why I really think this kind of looking into the real world, not just uni, just like a real company, real people, what they do from 9 to 5. I think this is something which is so undervalued in society. Like my friends at high school, I think they never really took these internships seriously as what they're meant to be. And I think that's one big issue what we have with this university system here in Switzerland and also in Germany, that a lot of people go to university into this subject without having to, you know, without having looked into a real job perspective or career perspective in that subject.
Yeah. I have a bunch of friends, they have never worked a job at 23. Yeah. Because they immediately go traveling or start studying. Maybe they do their master's now, but they've never worked a job.
Well, yeah, I think that's crazy. Because, like, I mean, sure, you don't have to, you know, work 3 months at a company and fix a contract or whatever. But at least try to find the opportunity to look into a work environment. Mm-hmm. Maybe, like, all these students' associations, I think a lot of them offer kind of these office visits where you can look into some company, learn what they do, and... I think this is really something you have to take advantage of if you don't know yet what your passion is going to be.
Yeah.
Because the worst thing you can do is not know your passion.
Until you need to make money.
Yeah, basically, right? Because as soon as you are kind of forced to make money, as soon as you don't have this freedom anymore to take chances and to take risks, then suddenly taking the time off to find out what you're passionate about is going to be a really, really tough financial decision. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can travel, you can study, but try to make sure that you kind of combine that with what you're passionate about. If you go to a third world country and kind of look at, I don't know, the overseas diplomatic workers or maybe like aid organizations, what they do there, and then you think, hell, maybe I want to be in Doctors Without Borders, right? Good for you, then do that, right? But if you're just traveling somewhere without focusing on, is this also going to be what I do every day for the rest of my life? Mm-hmm. Well, then you're not really trying to find what you're passionate about. You're just traveling.
You're just relaxing.
Yeah.
I invited you on this podcast because I wanted to give a perspective on finance in our 20s.
Yeah.
Because I feel like a lot of us have no clue. Literally. Like some have money and don't know what to do with it. Some don't have money and have an unhealthy relationship with it or don't know how to get out of a minimum salary job. Many of us don't know the finance terms that our parents are using. We also don't care because it's kind of boring, right?
Yeah,
but
I would disagree with the last part, but...
All right, yeah. But like, why is it important to know about finance and personal finance in our early years already?
Well, I don't necessarily think that you need to know everything when you're 20, but you should be able to budget roughly. And I think you should be able to have a rough understanding what kind of salary, what kind of bank account you plan to have in the future. Like right now, I'm also not flush with cash. You know, I was flush with cash when I used to work in software, but right now I'm doing my own thing and I'm experimenting. And I think I'm actually like a lot of 20-year-olds in the sense that I guess I'm quasi broke, yeah. you know.
Welcome yeah. to the team.
Exactly. Right. Obviously, I think I'm maybe a bit of the exception with the company on the side, but right now my company is not a point where we distribute earnings to shareholders. But I think what's more important is like the basics, you know, really the bare minimum, right? You should have an idea of how much cash goes in, right? How much are you earning or how much do you get from your parents or something? How much do you need to cover your like basic expenses? Mm. I don't think necessarily that you have to be Warren Buffett investment wizard at 25, right? Mm-hmm. I think at that point, the most important thing you can do is just make sure you have a bit of savings lying around just in case something bad happens. I think the most important thing for to get started at all in finance, just make sure that if an unforeseen catastrophe happens, if your house burns down or something, just make sure you have a couple, maybe 100 Swiss francs, or well, we're in Switzerland, so maybe a couple thousand Swiss francs yeah. on the side, just so, you know, if bad things happen to you, you have a reserve. But other than that, I don't think you need to do so much just yet, up to the point where your income gets higher, right? When your income starts to get higher, when you start to have a good paying job, then it becomes more important to plan for your future, to plan what to invest, what to maybe to retire on, this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So I think there's kind of the barrier, right? Until you find the job you're, I guess, passionate about, right? Focus bare minimum expenses, income, and just some reserves, right? And then after you have a job and you're kind of in the field where you feel comfortable and where you're making money, then I think it would be a good time to start thinking about investing, retirement, this kind of stuff.
So what I'm hearing here is that it maybe doesn't really make sense to invest when you're earning the bare minimum, because we can make that money again pretty fast.
I mean, it depends on each person, right?
Yeah.
I mean, in Switzerland, I guess some people already have a lot of cash, but I think for most students, to be honest, it's not so important to focus on investment. There's a lot of interesting literature on retail investors and what's a good investment strategy for retail clients. And one thing they noted
is... What's a retail client?
So retail basically means small investors, right? There's two levels, retail, normal people, so to speak, and then institutional, which is like large banks, large institutions, right? Mm. And the biggest thing that normal people get wrong about investing is timing, right? Because if you buy some stocks right now and you wait 40 years until your retirement, despite all of the market volatility, you're most likely to make a good return on your investment. What is a problem as a retail person is that if you buy and sell at the wrong moments, then you can lose a lot of upside in your investment. And that's why also if you look at returns of the stock market, the actual difference between the kind of real stock market returns and then what retail clients actually earn is largely explained through the fact that if you buy when you have, you know, a lot of money, right? Mm-hmm. So this is maybe, you know, 2021, market was booming, everyone had great paying jobs, and then you start buying a bunch of stocks kind of at the peak, and then you get laid off, right? Market drops, S&P 500 is down 50%.
You need the money again?
You need the money again, and you sell at the bad moment. And this is why I think it's crucial to have reserves first so that you don't start selling your investments at a bad time. Because if you start selling all of your assets at the moment when they're like at a low value, then this is going to eat into your return. So it's just better, as long as you only have a little bit of money or where you know that you might need to eat into that savings in the future again, don't try to be like crazy investment guy. If you just want to set aside a few thousand bucks just for savings purposes, just put them into a normal bank account where you can access them at all time, and wait till you get your 100K salary or something before you start investing for real.
I see. So you should have the safety money first before you think about starting to invest?
Yeah, because the timing is really the big thing in investing. This is the one thing I think everyone needs to understand about investing your money is timing. timing is everything, and the more short-term you focus, the harder it is to get the payoff right. That's why, you know, all these options contracts and these fancy financial products where you have a really short time window and everything has just to be right to get your return, this is not something I would ever recommend to a retail client. There you really have to be a sophisticated investor to time everything perfectly to actually make money on these products.
Mm-hmm.
On the opposite side, if you just wait 40 years, almost everything is going to go up, right? If you just buy some stocks for your retirement, timing is not a big issue.
Yeah.
And especially if you're like, you know, I'm almost finishing with my bachelor's. Maybe I'll do my master's, let's say, in the US. Now, this move in the US, it's going to drain my savings because I have to buy new furniture, I have to buy plane tickets and whatever, right? And in that case, it's better for me to just put some reserves aside so that I can pay for that in the future rather than putting that all into Bitcoin, trying to ride the wave. And then maybe if I'm unlucky, all the returns will be lost just because I have to sell at the wrong time.
I did put everything into Bitcoin, right? Literally all the money I earned.
Well, how did it go?
It went well.
Well, then I guess you were really lucky.
I guess I was lucky. And that's the thing. Like, I recommended it to all of my friends, right? Because I had a good time with it. But it's mostly luck, right?
Well, yeah, I mean,
with the way, like, noobs do it.
Yeah. If you focus on a one-month return as a retail client, it's really about luck. Like, if you have a really short-term investment focus, yeah, honestly, like, your returns will be mostly driven by luck.
But the thing is, I only invested all of my money because I didn't have any expenses. My parents still paid for everything. Like, I was 18 or something and no expenses. So I guess it was fine.
I mean, I think it's not necessarily a bad idea to kind of experiment with investing because you get a feel for it. And I think the first loss, it's better when you make your first loss while you're still young because you will get a feel for it and then also know what it's like to lose money.
Yeah,
it's a kind of, I think, a part of financial education to kind of try that out.
To try it.
Right? But I think if you are talking about larger sums of money and then also real investing, I think you should consider the future timeline and what kind of timing you expect in terms of what your income is going to be like, what your expense is going to be like, and when you might have to withdraw that money again.
That makes sense. So let's get a bit more basic. I'm 25. I have 20,000 Swiss francs on my bank account that I don't need right now. What should I do with it?
I mean, I think it's hard to, because, yeah, again, I think it really depends on your life circumstances. But I think in Switzerland, I will just put a ballpark figure here and say maybe 5,000 would be a good kind of savings, reserves, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. So again, depends on what you have planned for the future, depends on what your current expenses are. But let's just say you're a student, you pay $1,000 of living expenses per month and just want some flexibility there.
So maybe 2 to 3 monthly expenses.
Yeah. I mean, that depends on how much volatility you expect in your life. If you're going to move around a lot or if you're going to stay, if you're going to have a job or if you're going to switch your job. But let's just say $5,000 seems like a good figure.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's what you should keep in reserves. And then the $15,000 which is left, I think that you can then use at your own discretion. If you want to start investing, I think you can use some of that money to start investing to get a feel for it. I would recommend that you try to invest with a long-term horizon as possible. Like as long as possible and as long as you can tolerate living without the money. And then I guess whatever is left, you can then also use for, let's say, non-discretionary items, right?
If you for fun.
Yeah. I mean, you're 25, you should be able to have some fun in your life. Yeah. So I think that's really up to you.
Yeah. So like putting these 15,000 into investments, stocks or something versus putting them into yourself. For me, of course, I want to build a company.
Yeah.
I want to be self-sustained financially. So for me, I think the higher return on investment is actually putting this money into myself to grow some sort of business.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would be, I guess, also a good idea. Depends on kind of your circumstances again. If you already have a plan and if you already have an idea that you want to execute on, and it roughly falls in line with your current career path, then I think that's a good opportunity and also a good chance to take. You know, whilst you're still 25, and if you can live without that money and maybe you have some side jobs or something, I think it's a good time to take that risk and to also kind of explore yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, with my company, one really nice benefit is that even if my company doesn't do well, it's still very much on my career path. So it's still related to software engineering and still related to finance. And so even if I fail, I will still kind of move forward in my career path.
Yeah, that makes total sense.
So from that perspective, I think it's at a young age, and if you have, I guess, the money and also the opportunity to take that risk, mm-hmm. I think it's a good idea to do that as well. Mm-hmm. If you're maybe not sure yet, or maybe you are more interested in a corporate job, obviously what you can also do is you can think, for example, in finance, there are certain certifications you can get, which can obviously help also increase your salary. So maybe that's also something where, like the CFA, right? This is this Chartered Financial Accountants. It's this exam where you might have to expect to put in a couple thousand for the exam fees and the preparation material and everything. But if this is along your kind of future career path, and if you're interested in that, that's also a good thing to put your money on. Because with something like that, you're probably going to get a way higher return on investment than even putting it into the S&P 500.
Mm-hmm. So there's not only stocks and investments.
Yeah. No, I mean, you can put it into a company if you want to do something on your own. You can put it into education, I guess, or kind of certifications, which then can help increase your or later your salary. Or you can invest it in stocks and bonds.
Yeah.
And there, I think, especially at a young age, you have loads and loads of options. Because you're still, your life is still dynamic. Nothing is really fixed yet.
Yeah.
And so you have the opportunity to switch and try a bit and see.
You still have the space to fail.
Exactly. Yeah. And especially something like the CFA, right? If you're in an accounting job, then having something like that is a really good certification, which is really going to help later on. And if you're interested in photography, right?
Yeah.
So, for example, if you're interested in photography, what you can do is maybe you want to do some fancy project to show off your skills, to also kind of advertise yourself to a future employer. You can take maybe 5,000, buy some better equipment, and maybe another 5,000 to travel somewhere exotic, and then try to make like a really nice portfolio, something where you can then kind of increase your value as an employee, where you can say, here, look at this, right? I have experience. I do this. I'm above average, right? And this can then also help leverage your position.
That makes sense. So what I do with photography right now, I only do it for fun, because I actually intentionally reserve this passion for a hobby for myself, because I noticed the creativity goes down and the passion goes down as soon as I get money from it. It's a bit weird, but it's actually proven in like a study.
I think this is also what the passion is about, right? Because I think if you like photography and you're really passionate about it, then you can also combine that with money, you know? Like, you can be a creator if you're interested in that. Or if you... I mean, there are some, I guess, really top-tier marketing agencies or creative agencies where obviously they give you a lot more creative freedom than the 9-to-5 normal job. But I think they will also expect a higher level of standard. And I think that's... You know, that's in every industry the case. If you look at the top tier law firms, right, if you want to be like the best lawyer in the world working at Kirkland and Ellis, like the best law firm, whatever, then they're not going to hire someone who just has a normal resume, who shows up and does his thing. They're going to hire someone who is so wildly passionate about his job, his law, everything in that area, that maybe he takes a year off just to work in this niche field because he likes it so much.
Yeah.
And I think the same goes for every job. So
that reminds me of Alex Hormozi, one of my favorite guys. Mm-hmm. You know him?
No, I don't.
He's like a influencer for productivity and making money. businesses, and he always says, think in terms of hundreds of hours spent on a skill you want to develop. Like not 1 hour, 10 hours, maybe hundreds, maybe thousands of hours.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's why this whole passion thing is really important, because I enjoy software engineering so much. The last 3 years flew by like nothing. You don't notice, you enjoy it so much that you don't notice how much time you spent there. And ideally, you'll go to that job every morning and you'll enjoy it and you'll love it and you'll get paid and you'll just love it, mm-hmm. because it ticks all the boxes for you. Mm-hmm. There's this great, I guess, nonprofit or webpage. I think it's called 80,000 hours or something.
Okay.
That's how much an average person works in their lifetime, right? 80,000 hours. And their whole thing is trying to match people with jobs that can create an impact that people can be passionate about and where you can be kind of proud to work in. Because there's a lot of niche jobs and a lot of kind of crazy things you can do that can be really enjoyable, but people just don't know about them.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend, she studied at Harvard Law School, and obviously out of law school you have the option to go to a white shoe law firm and then do your stuff there, you know, get kind of do crazy work hours but get paid heavily, and that's an option. But she didn't want to be that kind of corporate lawyer. So she actually found a job. I don't remember what the name of the organization is. But basically what her thing is she helps states draft constitutions and help draft them like international legal frameworks, right? Mm-hmm. So basically she's working on the governmental level to advise especially failed states on how to improve, how to restructure their legal system to make a difference, how they can create a constitution framework to build upon and to build better.
That's like a thing you've never heard of, right?
Right. That's something where, you know, you, as a normal person, you don't think that such a job even exists.
Mm-hmm.
But now, you know, she told me that and I was like, that sounds amazing. That sounds so interesting.
Yeah.
Because that's a super, super niche field, right? You know, there's not a lot of people in the world that do this. But obviously, this is a job where you have a lot of impact, where you have the opportunity to get to know many, many people on a, like, actually powerful people, high-level contacts, and where you can make a difference. And I think these niche jobs and these opportunities, they are everywhere if you look for them.
Yeah. These are kind of things that you feel like you're not good enough to do them. They seem like too big or too crazy that you as a person could do them, like being the president of the United States.
Yeah.
But you actually could, you know.
Yeah, but exactly. Everything seems crazy until you do it, right? Yeah. And My thought was always, you know, someone has to do these jobs, right? So it might as well be you.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Nice.
All right.
Let's go quickly. I have a part-time job and zero savings. What's the fastest path to 1 million?
I don't like this question.
Yeah.
Because it's this question where, you
know. Is there a fast path?
There's going to be this influencer answer, you know, buy property and then you should do an Airbnb startup, do drop shipping, you know? Oh God, I see so many of these posts and it's terrible.
Let's bring the real stuff.
I think the real answer is this. First of all, if you have a part-time job, like I think the very first thing you should do is just try to make sure that you have some sort of job or full-time or whatever. Because if you're only invested half-time or part-time, I think it's going to be really tough to do $1 million. So either find a job or like a really well-paid one, I guess, or maybe start your company or something. Like, I think the easiest way and sort of maybe not the fastest, but the easiest is if you once again combine it with what you're passionate about and what kind of fits to you as a person. If you are great at photography, you like photography, and this is a skill you have, then your fastest path to $1 million is probably going to be in photography and not trying to force your way into finance.
Yeah.
Because if you don't have a background in finance, you don't have experience in finance, you don't enjoy working in finance, I think it's going to be hard to keep up the stamina and keep work all of that and put in so much effort just for this arbitrary goal of $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
if you do something where you're already good at what you love and what you can kind of, where you can find a business angle, and I think there's almost everything can be combined with a business angle.
Yeah.
Boom, you'll have a very enjoyable time to $1 million.
I love that. So you didn't start the company to get $1 million.
No, because, I mean, obviously everyone wants to get wealthy, right? You want to get rich and whatnot, but why is $1 million so important, right? Because the number on your bank account doesn't matter in the end. What matters is what life you can live and what your life will be like. Obviously, if you are constantly broke, you'll have a very miserable time, you know? If every day you're one paycheck away from being broke, losing your apartment or whatnot, then you'll be constantly stressed and have just a miserable time. But you're not going to be happier if you just have an arbitrary amount of money on your bank account. What's important for me is that I'm kind of financially free, that I have the savings to survive a shock, that I don't have to worry about being broke tomorrow or being on the street tomorrow. I think that having this freedom not to worry about that improves my quality of life by a lot. And
your peace of mind.
Yeah. And I think that's also what I noticed when I worked at Bloomberg and I earned my first really big paychecks. I didn't look into my bank account every day to track how much money I had. It was more of a thing where I could use my credit card and not have to worry so much, you know? I don't have to sweat so much about expenses, and it just gives you a certain peace of mind. And I think this is really how people should think about money, not as a goal itself, but rather as a means to an end, to not have to worry, to maybe have kids and then be able to pay for them, to retire, or, you know, to travel, right? You can make loads of money in your 20s and then enjoy your 30s by catching up on all the traveling, right? And so that's how I view what I want to work for and also what my goal is with the money I earn.
Yeah, it's funny because I wanted to go to South Korea again in the end of the year. This is kind of an emotional subject for me.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to meet a special someone. And
nice.
Yeah. But you know, it would take maybe a fourth of the amount of money that I currently have in cash and not invested. Literally, I have maybe 3,000, 4,000, something like this. And I told my business partner, and she said, no. She literally said, no, that's not what you can do right now. You can't do this right now, because our goal right now is to have a company in 3 months. And yeah, I'm sad about it, but she's right. And so I'm like, fuck, I really need to make this work to in the end have the money to do whatever the fuck I want to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a hard choice. I don't have a answer to that directly, because it's kind of this question, what do you sacrifice now to have in the future, right? And I think especially if you're a business owner or founder, you will have that question a lot, you know, basically sacrificing your 20s so that you can enjoy your 30s. And I don't think there's the one-stop-all answer for that. Yeah. I think it really depends on yourself. And I had this issue myself, or I have this issue every day. You know, every day you work and you kind of give up everything else to work on this one thing you want and what you love and what you're passionate about. You have to be willing to make that sacrifice.
Do you sacrifice on?
Well, I mean, obviously I spend a lot of time on my company, right? From the moment I wake up to the moment I go to sleep, I think about that. And I talk to my co-founders, and I talk to people that work with us and clients. And it's basically my whole life revolves around my company. And, you know, obviously I try to make time for social life, to do sports and to do these things. But in the end, my top priority is my company and the stuff that I'm building there, the business, and this is what I'm most passionate about. And I think when I scroll through Instagram and see my friends are flying to South Korea or doing a 1 year, how do you say,
traveling?
Yeah, traveling, whatever, right? You know, I think sometimes, damn, that'd be nice, you know?
Yeah.
But in the end, everyone has to make that decision. And for me, it's a hard one. It's not easy to say, okay, I'm going to focus on that exclusively. But I guess we'll see how it turns out. And I'm hoping for the best, you know?
I think you'll do well.
Yeah, and for me, it's what I like about my company and the work that I do there is that every year I can look back and think like, damn, this is how much I've accomplished this year. Just looking back now, we started the company, I think, like officially 2 years ago, pretty much 2 years ago, exactly. It's amazing how much we've accomplished. The team we've built, kind of the connection you have with your co-founders. And I don't, if I just were a normal student and did my normal thing and just kind of blocked that out completely, I don't think I would have this feeling of, okay, I actually have accomplished something in the last 2 years and I'm building something. And, you know, whether or not it's successful or not, I have improved myself as a person. You know, I've achieved something, and this is a skill that you can also have for the future.
And you're proud of what you did.
Yeah, I'm proud of what you did. And I'm proud of all the effort we put in. And, you know, even if the company would implode this afternoon, you know, today, and all the work imploded, everything gone, I would have way, way more return than the money I put in.
Yeah.
You know, because I put in like 8,000 for the GmbH. You know, we have four founders, so I put in 8,000 and the others 4,000 each.
Yeah.
And the 8,000 I got back multiplied by 20 or something, just in terms of the experience, all the things that I learned.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Because putting money into a company, into starting a company, is a commitment to growing the company.
Yeah, right. But I mean, this like this personal investment that you talked about before.
Yeah.
You know, the 8,000, obviously we used it to grow the company, but what did it bring me, right? I didn't get it back in cash. We didn't return any dividends yet, but I learned bunch about finance. You know, I learned about how to do sales, how to connect with people, how to talk to people, how to talk to decision makers. I wrote the biggest code base and I ever worked on in all the jobs that
I
did.
That's so cool. Yeah.
You know, I learned how to manage people, how to manage a team, how to work together as a team, how to, even where everyone is really pissed and everyone is just depressed, right?
Which happens a lot when you're starting a company.
Which happens all the time, right? You learn how to work through that and how to create a healthy working environment and how to keep people on board, how to basically, from my perspective, even if the whole company is gone tomorrow, I paid $8,000 to get the best management course, financial education course, sales course, marketing course that I could get for 8,000 euros, right?
I love that. That's amazing. Start a company.
Yeah. Yeah, but
if you want to.
If you think about it, right? If I compare this against studying, let's say, in the US, right? Even at a very, very cheap university, you will spend 30K a year in tuition. So basically, with $8,000, I could have bought at a really cheap college in the US, like a trimester maybe, or I could buy all of this experience I got from my company. And if you just compare these two things, right? Like a fraction of a year of college versus all this experience, right?
Yeah.
The putting down the investment into my company has been the best investment I ever did.
I love that. On finding your team and companies imploding, this happened to me recently. The team imploded. I'm still trying to figure out why, but how did you find your co-founders and how do you know they are good?
I don't think the people themselves matter so much, but how people work together matters way, way more than that. Because, you know, the team has to be better than the sum of parts. You know, that's how you, Like if I have 100% of capabilities, 100% of capabilities for my co-founder, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Us two put together should not just have 200% capabilities. Us two put together should have 1,000% capabilities.
Yeah.
Right? And in that sense, I was really very fortunate with my team. My co-founders are Andrin, whom I met here at university. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm a back-end guy. I don't do so much designing and the whole front-end engineering, whereas he does that stuff, right? So we really complement each other well because each of us can focus on the strengths, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we can kind of eliminate each other's weaknesses, right? And then my brother, Felix, I brought on as a CISO, who does our whole network infrastructure, our system infrastructure, and who focuses on security. And he's, I always say he's the annoying pedantic person, but in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
Because he has the attention to detail to make sure we don't screw up in a big way, right? Like he can do a really focused analysis of what we're building. And sometimes we give him a bad rep because he's always the guy to say, no, you cannot do it this way.
It's annoying, right?
Right? Yeah, it's annoying.
But you need that person in a company.
Exactly, right? Because without him, no one of us would do this job of making sure that we get things right.
Being an asshole.
Yeah, I don't want to call him that, but it's kind of true, yeah. And so he brings this kind of insane attention to detail and this focus. Every one of us lives with an attitude of, okay, we have to get it somehow deployed and we can live with 80%.
Yes.
And he brings in this mindset and says, no, it has to be 100% to the zero, right? And this adds value to us because he kind of complements our skills. And yeah. Then Frederik, he's someone I met here in Zurich. He worked 20 years in investment banking and trading, and he kind of brings the financial connection.
And the experience.
He didn't work in the same field where we're working now, but he brings kind of the older, I guess, more mature perspective and also the thinking of how people think in the market environment.
Yeah.
So he handles a lot of the sales perspective. And so each of us has a skill that no one else does. So we all complement each other perfectly. And we are all determined to make this work.
Mm-hmm.
And so we work really great as a team.
I love that. Yeah. I hope it keeps together somehow.
Yeah, thank you.
But even if it doesn't, like, I think you have the skills to let a person go and it's still going to be okay.
Well, I mean, in our team, I think it would be really a shame if anyone dropped out. But one mistake that I think many founders make, also looking for co-founders, is that you try to look for people who are like you. You know, you're trying to find someone, basically your mirror self. And that's not someone you should found a company with.
Because you're going to have conflicts, right?
Well, no. I mean, if you have kind of your, if you're kind of founding a company with yourself, you're not going to have conflicts.
Or I think so, because we do things in a similar way, but not exactly. And then it's like...
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's an aspect. But what I'm trying to get to more is that what you should really have is someone who's opposite of you, who can complement you and who can bring in stuff that you cannot bring in.
Mm-hmm.
Because what's the purpose of having two founders who are identical in a company, right? One of them is redundant. But if each of our founders does something completely different, something that no one else can do, that means no one is redundant, right?
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And obviously we have tons of conflicts, right? We fight each and every day, you know, but that's part of being in a company, right? That's how you know that it matters, because everyone puts in his perspective. Everyone has a different perspective on things. And even though we disagree, each one of us has one ultimate goal, and that is to bring the company forward.
Yeah.
And that's the healthiest basis to work together as a team.
That's how you know that people care, if you have conflicts. But what if you have too many of them? Like what I had in the old team was always clashing on, let's say I just wanted to make it work. I just wanted to put stuff out there. And one of my co-founders was more of the perfectionist side.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's good to be perfectionist, but also it was limiting the output.
Yeah.
And so I kind of, you know, you want to build an MVP and you want to bring it out,
mm-hmm.
but then someone else is saying like, oh, it's it's not up to my standards. Let's not put it out. What's your perspective on this?
I think in our team, we handled that kind of situation very well because you have to find a compromise. And initially, I think in the first year, it was really hard to get to compromise on things because obviously I was very much stuck in my perspective, kind of like you know, I just want to put something out. 80% is good enough. And Felix was still very much in his perfectionist position. But slowly but steadily, we kind of found a middle ground where, you know, we had this fight often enough. And I could accept Felix's perspective more that, yes, I should put in some more effort here to write some tests, write some half-decent code, make it a bit more stable. But Felix could also understand my perspective more that some of this stuff is unreasonable for a company of our size.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's actually one of the easiest fights to have and the easier one to resolve.
Mm.
What I think is really hard and something we dealt with in the last couple of months is when, you know, there are hard times in business, right? And where things are not going well. And then you will have fights where it's going to get personal. Not because you hate each other, not because, you know, not, I think for no real reason other than that everyone is stressed and everyone has put in so much effort and so much time and things are not going as everyone expected. And then you are kind of having a meltdown. This happened to us, and I think this is normal. This is part of being a human being, right? And then the hard thing there is to learn to stick together. Because your co-founders or the situation in our company, you know, it gets tense. You know, I had discussions where someone told me like, hey, you're not putting in enough effort, right? You're not working enough. And basically you kind of, everything gets tense. But then in the end, you have to remind yourself that you're on the same team. Mm-hmm. And I know it's hard to go through this period, but to me, I learned that they're not telling this to me because it's not a personal thing, right? Everyone is just stressed and everyone is having a hard time, just like I was having a hard time. And that's kind of a moment where you have to kind of make sure and remind yourself that you're on the same side, you're on the same team. And it might happen that you get really personal and angry and get like pissy with your co-founders. And, you know, I had times I wanted to scream at them, you know, and it was so bad. But we're still on the same team and we're in the same boat. And I think that's how you work through that.
That's what broke us, I think, getting personal. We got maybe a bit too personal. Can you get too personal in a team? What's your perspective? Like, should you be best friends privately or should you be work friends?
Well, I think in a startup and co-founder environment, you're going to be very, very tight.
Yeah.
But what I mean with personal is that you kind of attack each other like, hey, you're not working enough. You know, I put in 20 hours yesterday and you're not working enough. And like, then you're in this spiral where things are going bad and then you start to just make it worse because you're kind of fighting inside your team. I don't necessarily think that it's a bad thing to be personal or close with your founders. Because this fight, you know, hey, you're not doing enough or this is what you're doing wrong. This is something you will have no matter if they're your friends or if they're just your colleagues. I think this is a fight which also happens in, you know, corporate environments. But how you deal with this determines whether the team will survive or not. And I think having four founders is good in that perspective because if two of us are having a fight, there's still two to mediate, right? Yeah. And there's still someone else you can cry on his shoulder, right? And the thing is, in every fight, there's at least someone who's on your side, right? If I was fighting with Frederik, at least I had Felix on my side. If I was fighting with Andrin, I maybe had Frederik on my side. And if I had a fight with Felix, I maybe had Andrin on my side. And that way, you're not in this hopeless feeling of things are not going well. I'm all here alone and the other guy hates me, right?
Yeah.
And I think we're still in a phase where this future is still uncertain, but I think we're handling that actually very well. And in the end, like if you get in a situation, you just have to notice the problem and then try to change it.
Quick interruption. So at this point, Finlay and I went on a tangent about financial topics like securitization, which was pretty complicated. So I'm going to spare you that, just so you know.
I think people underestimate how much they can achieve and how much, how much they can actually do with their limited background or abilities. But if you focus on it, if you persevere, and if you talk to the right people, and if you learn, and if basically, you know, with Google right now, you have the ability to learn anything. Mm-hmm. And if you focus on that, you can. There are so many sectors just waiting for you to break into.
I just wanted to quickly get back to something you told me out of the podcast, which is when you had the internship at Bloomberg, that's where you kind of learned this.
Yeah.
That's where you got your feet wet in finance. How did you do this, and what did you do differently compared to the other interns?
Yeah, that was something we discussed before, right? At Bloomberg, they had this program called Bloomberg University where you could learn about finance. And this being in my mindset, trying to take away as much as possible from the internships, I worked there and they had this program. So I was like, okay, sure. I'm here to learn. I'm here to get the most out of it. So I'll just look at it and just kind of binge watched videos about financial products, right? They had at Bloomberg, they had this guy, I forget his name, basically who was just hired as an ex-Merrill Lynch banker to teach Bloomberg employees about finance.
Wow.
Right? So basically they had a experienced investment banker whose sole job was to teach Bloomberg employees about finance. And he made these great videos you could watch, like basically YouTube style, right? Mm-hmm. You know, these 2-hour lectures where he would talk about this is how stocks work, right? Historical performances, the investment criterias, you know, how business models, how cash flow analysis and all of this works. And I binge watched this like crazy. I swear to you, I watched more videos like this than I actually coded in my Bloomberg internship.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I learned a lot, and you learn the language and you learn how to think like them or how to jump into their shoes. And that taught me a lot. And I think that's something which a lot of other people that worked there didn't take advantage of. And because I talked to other interns, I asked them like, hey, what's your... Bloomberg had this internal chat thing called IB, Instant Bloomberg, where mm-hmm. you could just, any person who works at Bloomberg, you could just type in their name and text them. And, you know, I found other interns that worked there and I texted them like, hey, what kind of resources do you use to learn about finance, to learn more and to understand your job better? And a lot of them told me that, you know, they don't do anything like that, right? That they get their assignment, what to code on, they do it, and then that's it. The only thing I ever got was one guy who told me that he liked the movie Big Short. It's a good movie. Anyone who's listening, The Big Short, I can highly recommend it.
Okay.
Actually talks about securitization, but that's it, right? And
they watched a movie and you binge-watched hours of like complicated finance content.
Yeah, and I think this is so sad because you have the best opportunities, right? You are one of very, very, very few people who get to work in this environment, right? There are literally thousands of people who would, you know, kill someone just to get this opportunity. And you're sitting there and you're not trying to make the most out of it. And, you know, if for me, it was, they had this program. They even mentioned it in like the onboarding details or something. Like it was one of the programs advertised to interns. And, you know, if they have it, you got to take advantage of it. And honestly, like my managers, right? When I told them in the daily meetings that like, yeah, sorry, I didn't have time to code this because I watched like 4 hours of Bloomberg University yesterday. They were not mad. Like they found that amazing, right?
Yeah.
You know, that was like something they admired that I did that, and not like, not in a sense that, oh, he's slacking off work. You know, he's not doing enough. They saw that I would put in so much effort just to learn and understand and be kind of better at my job. They supported me in taking time at work just to learn about finance. So if you have that opportunity, why waste it?
I love that. Good stuff. What drives you in life? It's probably a bit similar, right?
Yeah, I that's a tough question. I don't have this like one drive, right? I don't have one goal I'm looking forward to. It's just more that I notice, or I try to pay attention to what I enjoy and what I like to do. And then I just try to do more of it. And for me, software engineering was something that interested me. And then it kind of snowballed from there. I was interested in it. I tried it. I kind of got my first taste and then ever more and more and more got involved with it. And for me, that's also, that's kind of how I approach everything. Like one of my other big passions is to do some social work, like basically volunteer outside the work that I do or outside university. And that really got started when I worked at Bloomberg. I mean, Bloomberg also has Bloomberg Philanthropies, right? It's one of the largest charity organizations in the world. Big shout out, Michael Bloomberg donates, I think, 90% of the profit to charity.
Wow. I guess he has enough money.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he has enough. But it's actually like they when I worked there, they sent me as a onboarding package the autobiography of Michael Bloomberg. Bloomberg by Bloomberg was one of the books everyone has to read. And wow. He has a whole chapter talking about charity. And I got my first taste, so to speak. I did like a volunteering project there and I just enjoyed it. It was so much fun to teach and to share some skills and to kind of do something where you have impact, right? And so these days I do that at university to some extent, where I work at the CSNOW, which is the organization from the computer science department, which promotes gender equality in computer science. And then also with ETH, I did like teaching projects where we would teach computer science at high schools in Switzerland. And for me, that was also something like, obviously that's not something where you can so easily make a career out of it, but something which for me has been kind of, you know, something to do in my free time that I think, okay, if I'm not working, then I can do some volunteering where I get to know loads of people and I can enjoy and get the same sense of passion that I do in the work that I do. And so I don't really have this one drive, this one goal where I'm working towards, but it's more that I tried different things and I'm constantly trying new things. And then I'm kind of always taking it from there and trying to see where the next step is going to be.
And as long as you find enjoyment in what you're doing, you're good, basically.
Yeah, right. Because, you know, life is short. You should try to enjoy it. Yeah. And I think I'm really lucky in that perspective that I can kind of combine what I'm passionate about and what I enjoy to also with something that can maybe make me money, can help me survive. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, that's the best combination, right? Yeah. Because, you know, you're not going to be depressed all the time.
Yeah. What's your message to the other 20-something-year-olds out there who are in our age?
Yeah, I think we said it before.
We did. We said it like 5 times, right?
Try to find your passion. Yeah.
Try to find your passion. Take the chances. Make the most out of the chances you get. Take risk.
Yeah, and I think try to get a perspective of what 1 year from now is going to look like, right? What you want to do in your life, what you want to do as your job. Basically, just try to get a feel of, yeah, I think the what drives you is maybe the wrong question, because I watched this great YouTube video recently where it was about that we spend life in this horizontal view, right? Where time moves forward and you constantly think about trying to think about like the next step, or you're preparing for the future all the time. But I think what a better way to think about is like thinking like vertically, right? Moving upwards, so to speak. You're not thinking about like
this.
Yeah, no, I mean, not like this, but really like vertically, right? Not time as a, like, not time as a horizontal line where every year passes by and you're basically, you start here and then you live and then and eventually you'll die here, but rather to think about your life as a kind of ladder where you're moving up. And I found this idea really compelling, because you spend so much time thinking about, ooh, I'm going to be 20 now, or I'm going to be 80, and then in my retirement, I'm going to do this and this. And then you're focused in this kind of horizontal view where you're always focused on preparing for the next step instead of just doing the next step. You know, like if you're trying to move up, the best way is to just take the next step and to get started. And I think this idea that you're building on yourself instead of just going forward is something that I found it very interesting, because it also kind of reflects the way that I live, that I'm trying to build on everything. Like every day I'm trying to build on what I did the last day and what I did yesterday, right? And step by step, I'm trying to move forward, to go upwards, right? And I think that is something where if you try to focus on that, you will get some passion out of it. And I think most people will find some enjoyment with it. And if you're 20 right now, make sure that your 20s aren't wasted, and that when you're 30, you're not going to sit there and think, damn, I don't know what to do when I'm 30. Because if you do that, then you'll not know what you'd do with your 40s, right? And then eventually you'll be in retirement and think, damn, maybe I should have done this or that.
Yeah, we really don't want to be in the end of our lives and look back and regret something.
Yeah. And well, I mean, you're only 20 once, right? You're only 21 once. And eventually things will work out, right? Eventually you'll have maybe a family or an environment where you're kind of fixed in, where you cannot move so easily out of it. Mm. And if you have the opportunities to try something, the best time is to just do it now and then make sure that you enjoy your future.
Thank you, Finlay, for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm very grateful for this conversation. Yeah.
No worries.
I hope you viewers and listeners gained some insight from this to figure out what you're going to do with your 20s. And
if you work in finance, give me a call.
Do that. Thank you, guys. Just a reminder that all the information shared on this podcast is for entertainment and informational purposes only and should not be taken as financial advice. Always consult with a professional first before making any big financial decisions.